In conversation with Farida Shahid. Farida Shahid can be contacted at farida@sgah.org.pk. In this interview, Arrow speaks with longtime feminist and activist Farida Shahid, who was the first independent expert and special rapporteur, SR, in the field of cultural rights from November 2009 to October 2015. The interview focuses on her thoughts on ways to ensure culture and religion are reconfigured to ensure women's human rights, including their sexual and reproductive health and rights, SRHR, and how the special procedures mandates can be used to raise these issues. Arrow program staff Ezra Abdul Kader and Maria Melinda, Malin, Ando conducted the interview. Please give us a brief introduction of yourself. I am the executive director of Sherkatga Women's Resource Center, a leading women's rights organization in Pakistan. I'm also a founding member of the National Lobby, Women's Action Forum, WAF, which was created in 1981 to resist the systematic rescinding of women's rights, and a founder/core group member of the International Solidarity Network Women Living Under Muslim Laws, for which I set up and ran the Asia Region Coordination Office within Sherkatga for decades. I have worked for more than 25 years to empower women and to further a gender-equal social justice agenda by building knowledge about and capacity to analyze and address actors and factors that keep women disempowered from the local to the international level, to help women differentiate between customary practices applied to them and legal rights, to facilitate access to legal rights, government schemes, and policies, and to provide linkage to sources of support for initiatives in personal and collective change agendas. Activism informs my scholastic work, conceptual analyses and understanding underpin my practical grassroots work, knowledge transfer, and building capacities. I have widely published on the interface of women, religion, identity, and state citizenship and how this impacts women's rights. I have also won numerous awards, and led efforts to take the voice of Pakistani women to international forums and to bring home international commitments. How was your mandate as special rapporteur used to raise issues of human rights violations, including for women's rights and sexual and reproductive health and rights, SRHR? Please share specific cases, if any. I have argued for the need for a paradigm shift from viewing culture as an obstacle to women's rights to demanding cultural rights for women on a basis of equality with men. After discussions and interactions with the CEDAW committee, I decided to write my 2012 report, which was submitted to the UN General Assembly, The Enjoyment of Cultural Rights by Women on an Equal Basis with Men. 1. The report does not take up the issue of SRHR specifically, but argues for the need to 20 challenge presumptions about cultural norms and to ensure that women move from the margins to the center of decision-making on all aspects of their lives, including determining what is cultural heritage, its interpretation, and decisions on what is to be kept, modified, or entirely discarded. I have also maintained that no cultural practices are in keeping with human rights norms and standards. All cultures have to move towards human rights. Conscious of the stranglehold that culture often imposes on women's agency, in my very first statement, I said that the right to participate in cultural life includes the right not to participate in any ritual or practice that undermines human dignity. The most specific nature of SRHR I have taken up is in communications and country reports related to the cultural rights of LGBT groups. Do you think issues of religion, religious fundamentalism, and extremism, and women's rights, including their SRHR, are related? How? What are the critical issues to consider in relation to these aspects? As said in my report on women, I think we need to ask the question differently. Women must not be obliged to choose between their human rights on the one hand and their religion or cultural affiliations on the other. The question is what needs to be done to ensure women are empowered to reconfigure culture and religion in ways that ensure all their human rights, and what can be done to ensure that states makes equal opportunities available for all genders, women, men, and others, to be heard. The danger of fundamentalism of any variety is the binary choices falsely put forward. You can either be, e.g., a member of a particular religious or cultural group, in which case you must follow specific rules, otherwise be cast out of the group altogether. In fact, culture is a site of contestations and for contesting meanings and is ever-changing and never static. Culture is reproduced or altered in the everyday acts we engage in. No society or community has just one culture, there is always a dominant culture, imposed by those with the power to ensure compliance with set rules, and subaltern cultures, including often the culture of human rights, but of women, and the marginalized. Belonging to a community does not confer equality. Culture relates crucially to issues of power and powerlessness. The fear of punitive actions and/or being cast out of their community is a major obstacle to women exercising agency to change the status quo. Religion is an integral part of culture, but not equivalent. People's lives are governed by a complex intermeshed set of socio-cultural norms and dictates. In societies where religion is a dominant force, these norms are cultural religious in nature. Lack of knowledge of religion helps people, especially women, fall victim to the self-serving interpretation of religion and culture by dominant patriarchal forces. The role of the state is crucial in determining the legitimacy of religious actors. Women must not be obliged to choose between their human rights on the one hand and their religion or cultural affiliations on the other. The question is what needs to be done to ensure women are empowered to reconfigure culture and religion in ways that ensure all their human rights, and what can be done to ensure that states makes equal opportunities available for all genders. Fundamentalist movements have a tendency to focus on the family and family norms, in particular sexuality and reproduction, to promote their control over society. Women and men who assume the norms of fundamentalism become markers of the territory appropriated by these forces. We too have sadly witnessed this in Pakistan, including to extremes. I also feel that it is crucial to also examine the role of the state and other actors. For example, donor agencies have been promoting the role of the imam for decades in terms of sanitation and other aspects of life where this group had no influence previously. Fundamentalist discourses find resonance with and support from pre-existing patriarchal norms and forces. The impact on sexual mores seems evident and comes accompanied with sets of rules, and corresponding punitive actions for transgressions, that further control, limit, and channel women's agency into certain directions, e.g., not working, being good housewives/mothers, prioritizing the needs of others over your own, dressing and behaving in particular ways and not others, amongst others. That said, there is no evidence of a direct correlation between the use of contraceptives and this discourse in Pakistan, nor are there any studies, that I know of, indicating a direct link with, for example, changed sexual behavior in terms of intercourse. I also feel that it is crucial to also examine the role of the state and other actors, e.g., donor agencies, educational institutions, and entertainment media, in this regard. For example, donor agencies have been promoting the role of the imam, mosque prayer leader, for decades in terms of sanitation and other aspects of life where this group had no influence previously. Furthermore, there is a need to understand religious fundamentalism in a continuum from religion and religious mores in general to the extreme for they are discursively linked. Would you agree that religious lobbies have taken over UN human rights mechanisms? In what way, s, and why? Has this been the case with the UN special procedures? Please elaborate. Can you also shed some light on the lobbying tactics employed by the religious lobbies, the participation of women in these lobbies, and the alliances they tend to make? I do not think that religious lobbies have taken over human rights mechanisms, but certainly, they have continued to make concerted efforts to push their agenda. This was very visible in the International Conference on Population and Development Process, which allowed actors from diverse denominations and religions to find common ground, and continued into and beyond the Beijing Conference. If such lobbies have gained strength in the UN system, it is due to the nature of the governments elected and sitting in the UN. The religious lobby/actors have been greatly strengthened following the collapse of the USSR and the socialist countries. The Church in Poland, for example, as a main provider of space for dissent under the previous totalitarian regimes, gained legitimacy and has been used by non-religious leaders when it suits their purpose. The strong presence of the church is also evident in Russia. Separately, there is 1. The strong influence of the oil-rich Middle East states on poor Muslim-majority states, combined with religion becoming a force of opposition in non-democratic countries. 2. In at least some countries of East and Southeast Asia, I think there is a parallel with churches and monasteries trying to build alternative narratives and centers of legitimacy than the erstwhile total control of the state, and 3. The strong and growing influence of evangelist preachers and missionaries in both Africa and South America. 22. Far more context-specific evidence-based analysis is needed of what is happening on the ground in different countries. This needs to connect with an analysis of global geopolitics. How can civil society and progressive advocates counter such efforts to ensure that human rights, including women's rights and SRHR, are achieved? A first step is being more nuanced about our understanding of the issue in terms of power bases and financial and other connections across the world. Far more context-specific evidence-based analysis is needed of what is happening on the ground in different countries. This needs to connect with an analysis of global geopolitics. For example, for decades, the West promoted the Taliban precursors as freedom fighters in Afghanistan, US versus USSR, allowing them to grow enormously in power. However, after the defeat of the Soviets in Afghanistan, the US lost interest, but some parts of the Pakistani state decided to use and create the Taliban for their own purposes. So there are wheels within wheels, and I am not sure if it is the same trajectory everywhere. For instance, why is the state of Brazil, where the majority is Catholic, not trying to stop the attacks carried out by evangelists against the local indigenous religions and their manifestations? How can civil society and the special rapporteur work together better to help each other achieve progressive outcomes? I would encourage Arrow to speak with the new special rapporteur, Karima Banoun, who is strong on the issue of fundamentalist forces. Generally, I would urge CSOs and individual advocates to make much better use of the UN Human Rights Special Procedures. These are easy to access and most of us are responsive. It is important to consider that special procedures mandate holders must keep within the mandate defined by the UN, but many, like myself, find ways of expanding these to include new issues. So CSOs need to consider all the possible angles of an issue and approach a maximum of mandate holders. For example, for SRHR and fundamentalism, you can start with the SR on health, but also with culture and the working group on women. However, as fundamentalists attack human rights defenders, a number of civil and political rights mandates would also fit, such as freedom of expression, access to information, and others. How can state parties be held more accountable to ensure these rights are achieved at the national level? Accountability of states is largely dependent on the strength of local organizations and advocates. International mechanisms such as the UN can only help to establish the parameters, norms, and standards for all. Ground change needs grounded groups. Towards this, it is necessary that CSOs are aware of and participate in the agenda-setting processes and ensure SRHR are on the table, and highlight the negative impact of the continuum of religious conservative to fundamentalist forces have on SRHR. But this requires effective, reliable documentation, which is often missing or inadequate. It is necessary that CSOs are aware of and participate in the agenda-setting processes and ensure SRHR are on the table, and highlight the negative impact of the continuum of religious conservative to fundamentalist forces have on SRHR. 23. Specific documented cases where rights are denied or threatened should be brought to the attention of the special procedures. Alternative reports should be prepared for treaties in which the country is a state party UN, and other UN agencies, and reports submitted to the UPR process for the specific country. Side panels and events can also be held when the Universal Periodic Review is being conducted, during the Human Rights Council sessions, or during the Third Committee sessions of the General Assembly in New York. SR mandate holders are often part of such panels. However, the aim of side panels and campaigns needs to be worked out well in advance. What do you hope to achieve? Is it change in language? Or adoption of a new resolution? This requires a lot of work. Or is it amendment in existing resolutions? This could also be in terms of the renewal of SR mandate holders, which happens yearly. So try and get language/issue addressed in the new resolution. Ultimately, however, I think CSOs need to understand that the terminology of the UN is very specific and any new language on religious fundamentalism is unlikely to get adopted, as this is too vaguely and/or differently defined concept. So it is more likely to get response to issues formulated around the terminology of extremism. However, you can refer to my report on women, which I think points to the way to future actions and is more specific than the SR on religious tolerance. How can UN accountability mechanisms be strengthened to ensure these rights in the face of increasing religious fundamentalism and extremism? Do you think it is important to harmonize these with other processes, particularly New York-led processes such as the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development? How do you think can this be done? I cannot offhand think of ways of strengthening accountability mechanisms. From the special procedures perspective, what we had asked for is that mandate holders be more closely involved in the universal periodic review that all states must report on. The problem there is that states have the option to accept or reject the recommendations. Accepted recommendations, however, make it easier to follow up. The human rights processes need to be integrated, and the SDGs must be seen, analyzed, and reviewed from a human rights perspective. SP mandate holders have also argued, at least since my tenure, in 2010, that there is a need for human rights to be integrated across all UN agencies and initiatives. We have said that we are willing and happy to assist in providing training/orientations in this respect. However, we find that whether or not human rights are integrated at the country/regional level is highly dependent on who is in charge. There are huge budget implications as well, since human rights, the third pillar of the UN, in fact, receives very little funding. Point 2. The human rights processes need to be integrated, and the SDGs must be seen, analyzed, and reviewed from a human rights perspective. However, this is exceedingly difficult because of the traditional way things have been, i.e., the division between human rights and development issues. The new HR indicators around the right of development can be a way forward and should be further explored. It should also be noted that the SDGs as a framework greatly reduce the role/scope of civil society in monitoring and assessments.